Animals Make Us Human, Disc 9.
For a lot of research, you have to start with observation before you can create a lab experiment or do a statistical analysis. A good example? Epidemiology always starts with observation. People notice that smokers seem to get more lung cancer than non-smokers, and then an epidemiologist uses scientific data collection and statistical tests to find out if there is a connection between smoking and lung cancer. Research on animal behavior should start with observation as often as possible. The Japanese researcher Tetsuro Matsuzawa is the only primatologist I know of who does both field work and lab research. He's been in the news a lot for his studies of chimpanzees beating humans in a memory task. In the experiment, the chimpanzees and humans have to remember the position of a sequence of 9 numbers on a computer screen. The chimpanzees always beat the humans. This is another revolutionary finding. Scientists have been doing laboratory studies on chimpanzees for years, but those studies took it for granted that chimpanzees had worse cognitive capacities than humans. I don't know of anyone who has done an experiment to find out whether chimpanzees might have cognitive capacities that are better than humans' cognitive capacities. I think a big part of the reason no one ever asked that question is that the researchers were all lab researchers. They didn't study chimpanzees living in their native habitat, where they might look smarter than they do living in a pen. Since Dr. Matsuzawa was studying chimpanzees in the field, he noticed that chimpanzees can do a lot of impressive things. One was that they can tell the difference between 200 different kinds of plants in the jungle. Dr. Matsuzawa says chimpanzees have a botanist's memory for plants. They remember everything, the individual plants, the time of year they grow, their locations, and their uses. No one working with chimpanzees in a lab setting is going to notice that. Fieldwork helps animal scientists ask the right questions. Another researcher, Nicola Clayton, who studies birds, also combines lab research with observation of bird behavior outside the lab. She is a biologist who started out researching the hippocampus in Eurasian jays and other birds that hide their food. Dr. Clayton found that the more food the birds hid, the bigger their hippocampus became. Traditionally, that's where the lab research would stop, with the researcher just looking at an isolated part of the animal's brain or body. But Dr. Clayton paid attention to what birds did in the wild, too. When she moved to the University of California, Davis, she noticed that western scrub jays were stealing pieces of people's food, hiding them, and then coming back later, not to eat the food, but to move it to a new hiding place. Why would they do this? She wanted to know. That was the jumping-off point for her lab research. She set up an experiment where she put scrub jays in a kind of suite with 3 miniature rooms like a hotel suite. The birds slept in the center room. Then the next day, the researchers moved them to one of the adjoining rooms. One room had lots of food. The room on the other side had nothing to eat. After a few days, the birds could choose which room they wanted to go into, and Dr. Clayton put food in the center room. When the birds found the food in the center room, they took it into the no-food room and hid it in an ice cube tray filled with sand that Dr. Clayton had put there. Dr. Clayton says this is evidence that the birds were planning ahead for the next time the experimenters put them inside the no-food room. That is a major discovery. The only animal that we know for sure plans ahead is humans. There have been a few studies saying that some primates can do it, but all of those animals were given lots of chances to learn to plan ahead, so they might be showing the effects of training, not of their own planning. In some of her other research, Dr. Clayton found that jays steal each other's food and that they remember where they've hidden food that decays quickly, such as worms, versus where they've hidden seeds and nuts. Dr. Clayton interprets this to mean that birds have episodic memory, which is memory for particular events or episodes in the past. That's another huge finding that wouldn't have come about if the researcher hadn't observed the way jays acted in the wild. Recently, Dr. Clayton has been working with a learning theorist at Cambridge named Anthony Dickinson. Dr. Dickinson says that when he first heard Dr. Clayton say birds had episodic memory, it was an outrageous statement. I don't think the statement that birds have episodic memory is outrageous. I think it's right. In Animals in Translation, I wrote about animals having autistic savant skills. Several scientists have challenged us and do not believe it. They say that it can't be true because people with autism are damaged and animals are normal. This is irrelevant. The memory feats of food-caching animals that can remember the location of hundreds of food stores are highly similar to the ability of some people with autism to memorize every street in a city. My theory is that savant-type skills occur when memories are sensory-based instead of language-based. Language leads to abstractification and loss of detail. Animals naturally lack language, and autistic people have language problems because of a disorder. But in autistic people and animals, the cause of sensory-based memory is the same, thinking and remembering in pictures instead of words. It's definitely possible to have episodic memory in pictures instead of words. I have many visual memories of specific events. Fieldwork outside the field. The field isn't just the jungle or Yellowstone Park or the Serengeti Plains. The field can be any place you find animals, including farms, ranches, feedlots, and research labs. As long as you're doing naturalistic observation of the animals, you're doing fieldwork. Naturalistic observation means the scientist observes a naturally occurring situation without trying to manipulate what happens. Naturalistic observation in a research lab would mean that the scientists observe what the research animals are doing when they're not in a formal experiment. There's a book out on Nim Chimpsky, one of the two chimpanzees that were raised with a human family so researchers could see whether they would develop grammatical language. Reading the book, I noticed that the most interesting things Nim didn't happen during the formal experiments. They happened in between the experiments, when he wanted something. I became totally convinced that Nim understood sign language when he banged on a closed door and signed, "Hurry open now." In her book, Don't Shoot the Dog, Karen Pryor says animal trainers can learn a lot about an animal's mind and emotions by observing how the animal reacts to reinforcement. She points out that if she sees a dolphin in a group of other dolphins jump up in the air and come down with a big splash, she doesn't know why he did that. But if she forgets to give a dolphin she's training a fish when he knows he's supposed to get a reward and he jumps up in the air and comes down with a huge splash directed right at her, then she knows that at least some of the time, jump splashes are aggressive displays. Different animals react different ways to trainers forgetting to give them the reinforcement they've earned, and those differences tell you something about the nature of their different personalities. You get that information only from close observation. Good science depends on good observation, no matter where you are, whether you're inside the lab or outside. Protecting wildlife through fieldwork. You have to have good fieldwork to protect wildlife. Cheetahs are an example. Laurie Marker, an expert on cheetahs who studies them in the wild, says that there are only 12,500 cheetahs in 26 different countries, which is the lowest population in 9,000 years. What's especially dangerous is that all cheetahs are so genetically similar to each other that they're almost clones. Geneticists say that would have happened because cheetahs went through a population bottleneck around 120,000 years ago when a catastrophic event, probably the Ice Age, wiped out almost all the cheetahs living at the time. The cheetahs that survived had to interbreed to reproduce. As a result, the 12,500 cheetahs that are alive now don't have enough genetic diversity to protect them from the next crisis. If one cheetah dies from the next bad feline virus that comes along, there's a chance that all the cheetahs could die from it. Cheetahs are going to need a lot of human intervention to survive. The current strategy is to protect cheetahs in the wild while breeding them in captivity as an insurance policy. Cheetahs have been especially hard to breed in captivity, but fieldwork has started to make it easier. Tim Caro's field study of cheetahs on the Serengeti Plains was a breakthrough because he found that male and female cheetahs don't live together in the wild. Zoos realized from his work that they needed to house their males and females in separate quarters. Lori Marker made the other big discovery, which was that in cheetahs, the female does the choosing. Normally, when you're trying to get animals to breed, you might bring a male several females he can date and court. He gets a choice. That doesn't work with cheetahs. In cheetah society, it's ladies' pick. You need to give her different boys she can choose from, and she's very picky. Even worse, Lori Marker also found that when you put female cheetahs together, they suppress each other's sex hormones. So if you want to breed them, you must house them separately. Thanks to all this good fieldwork, zoos are having better success breeding cheetahs in captivity. It's going to take good fieldwork to solve the terrible problems elephants are having. In Africa, elephants have been attacking and killing human beings and destroying villages and crops. Male elephants are raping and killing rhinoceroses and other elephants. The situation is so bad that in 2005 there was a report in Nature called Elephant Breakdown. One of the authors is the research director at the Amboseli Elephant Research Project in Kenya. The authors of the paper believe that elephants have experienced so much trauma that they have developed post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. They show all the signs of PTSD, abnormal startle response, depression, unpredictable behavior, and hyperaggression. A lot of the young males especially have become violent and are killing humans for revenge. The trauma comes from young elephants watching the matriarchs of their families get killed by poachers. Their elephant culture, which could have helped them deal with their trauma without becoming violent, has been destroyed. It's very bad to kill the older elephants. It's the older male and female elephants that keep the young males in line. There is no way to research this situation in the lab and find a solution. It's going to take close observation of elephants and hands-on rehabilitative work rearing orphaned elephants. The David Sheldrick Wildlife Trust is one organization that's trying to find a solution. They take little tiny baby orphan elephants that aren't wrecked yet and raise them not to have disgusting behaviors. For the first 2 years, people hand-feed the babies. During that time, the baby elephants form an intense attachment to their keepers. When the babies turn 2, the workers mix them with other young elephants, ages 3 to 5. At this stage, the 2-year-olds are still getting milk from people. Gradually, the older females in the group start to become natural matriarchs. While this is happening, the workers slowly wean the young elephants away from their human keepers. They have to do it slowly because the babies are in love with their keepers. Baby elephants have to be taught manners by older elephants, so the 2-year-olds stay with the group during the day and come back to sleep with their keepers at night. The keepers teach them some manners, too. Even when the babies are really young, they're never allowed to physically push a person. Mountain lion attacks on people. Africa isn't the only place having dangerous problems between people and wildlife. We need good fieldwork in this country to keep people from getting attacked and killed by predator species such as mountain lions and grizzly bears. We also need educated citizens who know enough to listen to field workers. The Beast in the Garden by David Barron is a really good book on this subject. Mr. Barron starts the book with a search for a missing jogger outside a small town close to Boulder, Colorado. When the searchers find the jogger's body, at first they think he's been attacked by a crazed serial killer. Here's a passage from The Beast in the Garden. The body, clothed in athletic gear, wasn't sloppily mangled. It was carefully carved, hollowed out like a pumpkin. Someone had cut a circle from the front of the sweatshirt and the turquoise t-shirt beneath, sliced through the skin and bones, exposed the chest cavity, and plucked out the organs. After conducting this ghoulish backwoods surgery, the killer had removed his victim's face and then sprinkled moss and twigs on the lower torso as if performing a macabre ritual. While the men are standing around staring at the body, one of the searchers looks behind them and sees a mountain lion sitting on its haunches, watching them. The lion was the killer. Everyone had always thought mountain lions don't kill people, and at that time, in 1991, no mountain lion had killed and eaten a human being in over a century. But some of the field workers who studied the animals knew that their behavior was changing. Mountain lions had always stayed away from humans, but now they were coming close enough to people's houses that residents could watch them out their windows. The field workers knew that was a very bad sign, but residents and even the professionals in the wildlife department didn't see anything wrong with it. Everyone liked living close to nature, and they interpreted the lion's behavior as a sign that humans and wild animals could live together peacefully. But that wasn't what was going on inside the lion's minds. What was going on inside the lion's minds was that they were learning that people could be prey. The mountain lions weren't getting tame. They were gradually developing stalking behavior. First, they came closer and closer to people's houses. Then they picked off some pets, and finally they started attacking people. But no one would listen when field workers told them that's what was happening. Even after the jogger was killed, citizens still didn't want to do anything about the lions. The other really bad thing that happened, and that's still going on today, is that people are acting like prey. Humans are jogging and riding bikes in the woods. Fast motion is prey behavior, and it triggers the prey chase drive in predators. Nobody should jog or bike in an area that has predator animals living in it, and nobody would if people listened to field workers who know how wild animals think and act. When I was in my teens in the 1960s, I went to boarding school in New England, and we often hiked in the woods, even though everybody talked about George the mountain lion that lived in the area. One night, George was seen crossing the parking lot, and nobody worried about him. I made a George costume and wore it for winter carnival. In the 1960s, people didn't jog or bike in the woods, so George never bothered anyone. Preserving the ecosystem. You need field work to preserve the ecosystem animals live in, too. Scientific American had an interesting article about bears and forests. Bears eat salmon, and in the 1940s, Alaskan fishermen were so worried about bears eating all the salmon that they wanted to have a big culling operation. That didn't happen, and it's a good thing it didn't, because two field researchers named Scott Gendy and Thomas Quinn have discovered that if you don't have bears to eat the salmon, you might not have a forest either. The way it works is that bears kill lots more salmon than they eat, and they eat only the good parts of the salmon. Sometimes they just eat the eggs and throw away the whole fish. Also, because bears are mostly solitary, they don't eat the salmon right there in the water where they caught it. They take it into the forest so they won't get in fights with other bears trying to take their food away. When they get to someplace safe, they eat the part of the fish they want and then leave the rest of the body behind. That's good for insects, birds, and smaller animals that eat the carcass. It's also good for the forest, because once the other animals have finished with the carcass, it breaks down and fertilizes the soil. These innovative researchers found that in some places, 70% of the nitrogen in streamside trees and bushes comes from salmon. Scott Gendy and Thomas Quinn say, "The bears are truly ecosystem engineers. They deliver marine-derived nutrients to the riparian streamside system." Grazing is another example where fieldwork has shown that people's assumptions about what's good and bad for the environment were wrong. There are people who say livestock are bad because they wreck the range. A lot of times that's true. But when cattle or other grazing animals are used correctly, they improve the range. As a matter of fact, you have to have grazing animals in order to have decent grasslands at all. The Great Plains were created by the bison. We learned this from field workers who studied the big migratory herds of wildebeests that used to roam the plains of Africa. Grazing animals in a wild herd always stay close together to give each other maximum protection from predators. Wildebeests have four predators: lions, cheetahs, hyenas, and hunting dogs, so they were always tightly stocked. They had to eat everything on the plain, not just the good stuff. They would come into one part of the pasture and mow it down, but then move to a new patch of ground long before they damaged the pasture. While they were eating, they were pooping on the ground and fertilizing the plants. When they finished grazing and fertilizing one area, they moved to another area, and the grass and forage in the grazed areas had plenty of time to regrow before they returned. Grasslands can't exist without big migratory bison herds or properly grazed domestic cattle to mow it. Alan Savory, an expert on the ecology of land development, says there are two kinds of land in the world, brittle and non-brittle. Brittle land easily turns into desert. Non-brittle land doesn't. The major difference between the two is that non-brittle land has moisture year-round, whereas brittle land has dry spells. The difference isn't total rainfall. There are parts of Africa with high rainfall where the land is still brittle because those areas have one long dry spell each year. Some places go as long as 8 months without any rain and then get 60 inches of rainfall during the other 4 months. Alan Savory discovered what happens when you let these lands lie fallow, when you remove all grazing animals. Non-brittle areas revert to forest, but the brittle lands turn into desert. I've seen desertification happen in Arizona. I was horrified when I drove by some of the rangeland in the early 2000s. Back in the 1970s, it used to be beautiful pasture with a diversity of plant species, but now it's an ugly desert full of juniper bushes. There is no kind of land that turns into a grassland on its own. Grasslands are created and maintained by both grazing animals and fire. Grazing done wrong can ruin the land, but so can no grazing at all. Brittle land you don't graze gets all nasty. Now the land has tufts of grass with dried-up dirt in between each patch. The difference between brittle pasture that is grazed correctly and ungrazed land is striking when you look along a fence line. One reason people think grazing is bad is that cattle on a ranch with poor grazing management will spread out over a big area and just eat the ice cream and cookies, the grass, and leave the weeds. They're also too spread out to fertilize and evenly eat the pasture. To get domestic cattle to graze the way wildebeests and bison graze, you need to make them stay bunched. In rough, hilly country, Bud Williams's quiet herding methods work. On the flat plains, portable electric fences are one of the most effective ways to make cattle mimic the behavior of the great herds of bison. The cattle are allowed to graze a piece of ground for a few days, and then they are moved. Today, the Nature Conservancy considers grazing part of a good conservation program, but we wouldn't have known this without good fieldwork. Pasture rotation systems developed by innovative ranchers can greatly improve the condition of the range. Being a pioneer is hard. Being a pioneering field worker takes dedication. When Alan Savory first presented his observations from his work in Africa, many people thought he was crazy. I remember a long conversation I had with Alan in the 1970s after he had given one of his first talks at a livestock meeting in the United States. He knew he was right, but he had to withstand attacks from people who said he was wrecking ranches. It was a conflict between the academic scientists and a field worker. Today, many ranchers are using his pasture rotation methods with great success, and some forward-thinking scientists have done studies that show that they work. Alan Savory calls his land management system holistic management because it takes many factors into account. Fieldwork is probably always more likely to be holistic than lab work or mathematical modeling because in the field you can't get away from the whole when a research project starts. A field worker might not understand a whole ecosystem any better than bench scientists or model builders, but you're always dealing with it. After a while, field workers get a feel for the whole system. Bench scientists can study only one or two isolated variables at a time, and modelers can include only the parts of a system they understand well enough to build models for. An example of that is the global warming models, which include fluid dynamics for the ocean and the atmosphere, but mostly leave out clouds and dust because scientists don't understand clouds and dust well enough yet to model them mathematically. I'm not saying global warming models are wrong. I'm just saying they can't include all the factors that go into climate. It's true with wildlife, too. No model can include all the strange things that are affecting animals and the ecosystems they live in. Models describe a world that's too pure. Bench scientists and field workers need to work with each other. Unfortunately, the passion that makes a great field worker often clashes with academia. The great field workers are pioneering spirits who go where no one has gone before, and they're impatient with the slow, incremental approach of formal science. Sometimes they make the mistake of attacking academic scientists instead of finding the creative academics who can verify their observations. Some of the best research combines bench science, such as DNA analysis, with painstaking fieldwork. In the field of botany, the molecular biologists are collaborating with the hands-on scientists who study whole plants. This will provide a better understanding of plant species and help prevent them from going extinct. A similar approach also works well for wildlife. Need for hands-on learning. Why do we have a serious shortage of people going into field work? I think it might go back to childhood, with children staying indoors and playing virtual basketball instead of going outside to shoot hoops. Richard Louv, who wrote the book Last Child in the Woods, says kids have nature deficit disorder. He talks about one boy who said he preferred to play inside because that's where the electrical outlets are. Today, many children have little time for unstructured play outdoors where they can explore and get interested in the natural world. Childhood interests in animals or plants are often the reason a person goes into a career that involves fieldwork. Unstructured outdoor play also teaches valuable problem-solving skills. I see all kinds of problems with college students who have never had an art class or built anything themselves. This lack of hands-on experience really hurts their understanding of how different things relate to each other in the physical world. My design students, especially the ones who never learned to use a compass or draw by hand, can't make proper drawings. I've been teaching my livestock handling facility design class for 18 years. Since around 2000, the percentage of students having difficulty with the drawings has increased. I think this is due to lack of hands-on experience with drawing in grade school. Last semester, I told my students to buy a compass to draw circles with. One girl came up to me after class and said, "Dr. Grandin, I bought a compass and I'm having trouble with my homework." She couldn't figure out how to draw different sizes of circles. When I looked at what she was doing, I found out she had bought a Boy Scout compass and was tracing a circle around its circumference. It's not just students either. I review drawings from plants around the world and I find the same errors in plans done by draftsmen. Older draftsmen who learn to draw by hand and then switch to the computer do fine. But younger ones who learned to make scale drawings on the computer make basic mistakes like not knowing where the center of a circle is. The problem is that younger draftsmen have never used a compass to draw a circle and have never built anything with their hands. They don't see their mistakes on a computer-drawn circle because they have never felt where the center of the circle is by sticking the point of a compass in the center. Touch helps the eye to perceive accurately. Oliver Sacks describes a person who was blind and regained vision as an adult. To understand the meaning of things he saw with his eyes, he had to touch the objects he was looking at. I believe that there is something fundamental about the nervous system that prevents the computer mouse from being connected to the brain the same way touch is. Touching and feeling objects are essential for accurate perception. The field of engineering is becoming overly abstract, too. Colleges and universities are teaching more engineering science and less engineering design. It used to be that anyone graduating with a degree in engineering knew how to design a combustion engine. Today, the majority of engineering students can't do it. An article that ran in Technology Review over 20 years ago said that students may have studied the strengths and properties of various materials or the way gases flow and react in turbines, but they have not necessarily learned how the parts of an engine are designed, manufactured, and assembled, or even how the components work. Fortunately, there are some innovative engineering programs where first-year students have the opportunity to design and test a prototype of a new product. Students who participate in these hands-on activities are less likely to drop out of the program. Making real change to improve animal conditions. I think people in general are becoming abstractified. You always hear about autistic children living in their own little world, but these days it's normal people who are living in their own little world of words and politics. Things have changed. People who wanted to help animals used to study animal behavior. Today, they go to law school. That's bad because when everything goes through lawyers, you lose sight of the real animals. I'm going to give you examples from my experience in the livestock industry, but the principles I have learned would also apply to wildlife issues. A good example is that the Humane Society in the 1970s used to send representatives to sit in on board meetings of the major livestock associations. That gave the Humane Society direct knowledge of how the livestock industry worked and what things they could change and still stay in business. In the 1980s, the Humane Society of the United States donated money to fund the development of my center track restrainer system for meat plants. They would never do that today. Few animal welfare groups would fund something to help reform and improve the livestock industry. As people have become more abstractified, they've become more radical. And today, the relationship between animal advocacy groups and the livestock industry is totally adversarial. You see this at every level. Recently, I went to a college that has a program on animals and public policy. The only publications they had in their library were animal advocacy magazines. I said, "Look, I think you need to subscribe to Feedstuffs, Beef, Meat and Poultry, and National Hog Farmer. You need to get the magazines read by the industry. To make policy that will work, you need information on every side of the issue." Dave Fraser, a respected animal welfare scientist at the University of British Columbia, says that to understand an issue, you need to read literature that is not from the most extremist people. I believe he's right. Both animal advocacy organizations and livestock groups often respond to complex issues with simplistic and contradictory information. Throughout my career, I've observed that on most issues, the best way to solve animal problems is to take an approach that is somewhat in the middle between extremist positions. I tell my students that truth is somewhere in the middle. Sometimes radical politics are good. I would never have been hired to set up the McDonald's audit system without activists. I use a metalworking analogy to think about animal welfare politics. The big companies are like steel, and activists are like heat. Activists soften the steel, and then I can bend it into pretty grillwork and make reforms. However, a totally abstractified, legal approach to animal welfare is bad for animals because of the unintended consequences that happen when animal rights organizations try to change things just by passing laws and filing lawsuits. The problem with the legal approach is that it's so abstract that the people have difficulty predicting what will actually happen in the field. Look at the situation with horse slaughter in the United States. The Humane Society managed to get all the horse slaughter plants shut down in America. Now the old Amish carriage horses and other unfortunate equines are getting transported down to Mexico, where they're worked and starved until they drop dead from lack of nutrition and overwork. If I were a retired Amish carriage horse, would I rather get hitched up to an old pickup truck and get sores and go hungry, or go to a U.S. slaughter plant? I got into a discussion with some of the people trying to shut down the plants once, and I said, "You want to make sure, if you do this, the horses don't have a worse fate." My worst nightmares came true. Thousands of horses have traveled to Mexico, where they were killed by the barbaric process of stabbing them in the back of the neck. Yes, in an ideal world, all retired and unrideable horses would go to sanctuaries, but we don't live in an ideal world. We need more animal welfare activists like my friend Henry Spira. Henry was totally rational. He was an old labor negotiator for the National Maritime Union. Henry dressed like a complete slob. He lived in a little rent-controlled apartment with his two cats and a bunch of pieces of cardboard boxes the cats had scratched up. He called them cat sculptures. Henry was probably slightly Asperger's. He had a little organization called Animal Rights International that was basically his apartment, and he was very effective. People who are interested in wildlife conservation should learn his methods. He got Revlon to stop testing cosmetics on animals. One thing about Henry that made him effective, his word was absolutely good. When Revlon made reforms, other activists kept on bashing them, but Henry said, "You need to back off of Revlon. Perhaps they're not perfect, but they're one of the good guys." Henry knew when to apply pressure and when to back off. He made constructive change happen on the ground. Henry died of cancer in 1998. We need more people like him today. Activists need to find out what is actually happening in the field so that true reform will occur instead of the tragic mess of unintended consequences that hurt animals. Make wild animals economically valuable to local people. If you're going to preserve wild animals, you have to make the animals economically valuable to the people in the countries where the animals live. You can't just order people to leave the animals alone if the animals aren't leaving the people alone. If I'm a local tribesman or a farmer and elephants eat all my family's food, I'm not going to feel very charitable toward elephants. Wild animals are going to have to be managed or they're going to die, so incentives have to be in place for local people to want to keep them around. One way to make the animals valuable to the local people is ecotourism. The locals will protect the animals if they can make a living from the tourists. The Snow Leopard Conservancy of India has developed a program called Homestays, where visitors can stay in the houses of local Mongolian herders who have agreed to protect the leopards. The herders make money, and the conservancy also pays for sturdy corrals to protect the herders' livestock. Rodney Jackson, the founder of the conservancy, estimates that each project to make a villager's corrals leopard-proof saves 5 leopards. They also worked with local religious leaders to persuade the herders that wild animals should be protected. Ultimately, there are 2 ways to manage wildlife. The first is national parks. To have a natural environment, the park needs to have sufficient land for the ecosystem to function. The big predators need more land than the smaller animals. If the land area is too small to support lions and other large predators, other species will overpopulate the area. It's essential to maintain the great national parks such as Yellowstone in the United States and Kruger National Park in Africa. The park systems around the world should be expanded both on land and in the ocean. The second approach is to manage wildlife outside the parks. These are the areas where the greatest losses are occurring. In the less developed parts of the world, the wildlife will be destroyed by poaching or land development unless the landowners have economic incentives to preserve it. For tourism to work as an economic incentive to protect wildlife, the money earned by the local people must enable them to support themselves and cover cost of damage to their crops and livestock caused by wildlife. Mike Norton Griffiths, a conservationist living in Kenya, says that since 1977, Kenya has lost between 60% and 70% of its big wild animals in the areas outside the national parks. It was in 1977 that Kenya passed laws making it illegal to hunt wild animals or raise them on ranches to sell for profit. That isn't a coincidence. It was the law that caused the animals to disappear. It made things worse. The large animal advocacy groups are still defending their law. The law hurt the animals by making their habitat disappear. Before 1977, wild animals lived in 2 places, government preserves and privately owned open-range grasslands owned by wildlife ranchers. Once wildlife ranching was made illegal, ranchers couldn't afford to maintain their grasslands. They had to plow up the rangelands and plant crops to support themselves. That law does exactly the opposite of what we need to do to protect the animals. Laws need to be passed that create an incentive for people to take care of the animals. The 1977 law created an economic incentive to destroy the grasslands and deprived the animals of habitat. African landowners make some of their biggest money selling big game hunting safaris. I found lots of websites advertising them. A typical price for a 10-day trip to shoot antelopes and warthogs costs $9,500. This doesn't include the airfare. A 21-day trip sells for $40,000. These prices will support a lot of local people. I'm not a fan of big game hunting, and it's an activity I will not participate in, but sacrificing some warthogs, antelopes, or wildebeests that are held on private land may be necessary to motivate landowners to preserve their land as wildlife habitat. It took me 25 years to learn that money is a major motivator and that economic factors can work either to help animals or to hurt them. Poachers and criminals kill animals because there's a market for products such as ivory, rhino horn, and other animal parts. If activists developed effective educational programs that convinced the younger generation in Asia they should not buy products made from the furs or organs of wild animals, that would benefit animals more than passing laws in Africa. You have to remove the economic incentive to poach wildlife, and you have to create economic incentives to protect wild animals and their habitat. You can't pass laws against human nature. If you do, the animals will suffer. Can people manage complex systems? People involved in wildlife policies need to learn more about how complex systems operate. There's a famous book called The Logic of Failure by Dietrich Dorner, about what happens when people try to manage complex systems. Dr. Dorner is a German psychologist who did a lot of computer simulation studies where he had experts manage complex systems he created. In one of the simulations, people had to manage a West African tribe of semi-nomadic people called the Moros, who raise cattle and millet. In the beginning of the simulation, the Moro are a mess. Their infant mortality is high, their life expectancy is low, they've got famines, and their cattle have tsetse flies. At the start of the simulation, everyone had a lot of tools to work with: money, fertilizer, the ability to drill more wells, the capacity to set up a healthcare system, and so on. The people in Dr. Dorner's experiment were very smart and well-educated, but almost all of them ended up making the situation much worse than it was to start. After just 2 simulated decades, Dr. Dorner says, the Moros were now in a hopeless situation that could only be alleviated by a massive infusion of outside aid. Not everyone in the experiment failed, however. The people who succeeded at managing a complex system were like field workers. They were practical, not ideological. They observed what was going on with the Moros, and they constantly asked themselves if what they were doing was working. They especially looked out for surprises, for things they didn't expect to happen. Whenever surprises popped up, they adjusted their actions to take the new information into account. That is the opposite of abstractification. Dr. Dorner says that the effectiveness of a measure almost always depends on the context within which the measure is pursued. A measure that produces good effects in one situation may do damage in another, and there are few general rules, rules that remain valid regardless of conditions surrounding them, that we can use to guide our actions. Every situation has to be considered afresh. In my work, I call that animals will throw you a curveball. Animals have a mind of their own, and they'll sometimes behave in ways that are difficult to predict. You have to pay attention and change your design if you need to. Teaching students how to observe. I've lived in Fort Collins, Colorado, for 18 years, and I've noticed how the behavior of the Canada geese has changed. They used to always stay together in large flocks, but today I see more and more single pairs around town. A pair may be grazing on the bank's front lawn or nesting under the steps of our campus building. Since they are not hunted in town, they are spreading out and flocking less. People who are good at fieldwork immediately notice these important details of how animal behavior changes as the conditions change. I have an exercise I do in my livestock handling class to try to teach students how to understand animals through observation instead of abstractification. I have them capture and handle imaginary animals. There's a fire-breathing dragon in the foothills, I tell them, and your job is to bring him back alive without having him burn up Fort Collins and our university. Or there's a 10-foot-high daddy longlegs out in a field. Your job is to bring him back to the lab alive without breaking his legs. I tell them they can't use anything made up. They can't get a magic ray gun and shoot the dragon and bring him back. They have to work with things we have now in the real world. The first reaction of the veterinarians in the class is always, "Let's shoot him up with drugs." I always say to them, "You don't know anything about this dragon, and you're going to shoot him full of ketamine? You don't know if tranquilizing drugs will work, or if they'll kill him, or if they'll just make him mad. You might get him enraged, and he could trash Fort Collins." Then I tell my students, "Why don't you just watch him a little while?" One thing I might want to know if I were trying to catch a dragon is how long it takes to regenerate his fire. I might get in a helicopter and tweak him just a little, not to hurt him, but to get him to blow out his fire. If it takes a couple of hours for the dragon to regenerate his fire, that's the safe time to catch him. With the 10-foot-tall daddy longlegs, students will instantly say, "Let's go out with horses and rope him." I say, "You'll break his legs." After that, they're usually stumped. I remind them, "Remember, insects shut down in the cold because they are cold-blooded. So I tell them we should wait until the temperature drops to catch him, or, if we have to catch him now, we'll have to chill him." Then I get the students brainstorming on how to chill him without freezing him and causing death. They think of all kinds of tents that could be put around him and hooked up to an air conditioning unit for chilling. After that, I ask them how we're going to transport him to Denver without breaking his legs. Usually, they have no idea, so I give hints. "There's something very common that will work," I say. "We have lots of them here in Colorado." The answer is refrigerated trucks. Once I've got him chilled, I can fold him up, put him inside the truck, set the refrigerator unit to about 45 degrees, and transport him to Denver. That's the way a field worker thinks. Chapter 9. Zoos. When I was a child, going to the zoo, the monkeys and the big cats and all the other animals lived in enclosures that looked like tiled bathrooms. There was nothing for them to do. I remember one poor elephant that just stood in one place and swayed back and forth. It was terrible. Things weren't any better in the 1970s when I lived in Arizona. For my animal behavior class, we had to go to the zoo to observe an animal, but there was almost no animal behavior at the zoo to observe. There was no point observing the coyote because all he did was endless circling stereotypies. The big cat slept all day because Phoenix was so hot. I finally chose the oryx antelopes because they were one of the few animals that lived in a large enclosure where a group of animals had opportunities for somewhat varied behavior. I watched two males in adjacent pens sparring with each other by sticking their horns through the mesh of a chain-link fence. That was the most interesting thing any animal had to do with itself in the entire zoo. The first feeble attempt that zoos made to improve the cages was to add some ropes for the monkeys to swing on. So the monkeys lived in tiled bathrooms with ropes, while all the other animals went on sleeping all day or pacing in circles. Fortunately, many zoos have made a lot of progress creating good environments for their animals since then. One meta-analysis of 20 studies of enrichment programs found that the programs have reduced stereotyping by 50% on average. That's a very large effect. Zoos have also developed a good set of common sense criteria to judge an animal's welfare. Is the animal acting normal? Does it have abnormal behaviors such as repetitive stereotypies, abnormal aggression, or self-injury? Is the animal busy doing different things? Does it have a wide repertoire of behavior? Is the animal confident? Does it freely move around its enclosure without acting afraid? Does the animal act relaxed when it's resting? Or does it act hypervigilant and on guard? These four questions are a simple, common sense audit of captive animal welfare, and zoo employees who know their animals well can easily ask and answer them. Zookeepers who understand the purpose of the questions have been able to collect a lot of useful information about what captive animals need to have a good mental and emotional life. What needs to happen next is that all zookeepers should learn to identify abnormal behavior. I visited an aquarium where a single dolphin was swimming around and around his pool in a repetitive pattern that never varied. He swam the entire length of the tank along the bottom and then swam up at a 45-degree angle to the corner across the pool. When he got to the top corner, he turned and swam the length of the tank at the surface, and then he followed a second diagonal at a 45-degree angle down to the corner at the bottom of the tank, which put him back where he started. A lot of animals develop circular stereotypies where they move in one plane, but this dolphin had developed a figure eight that used all three dimensions of the tank. His path was unusual enough that the keepers were not aware that this was an abnormal stereotypy. The best zoos train their staffs, but there are still too many zoo managers who don't fully recognize the importance of providing enrichment to prevent abnormal behavior, partly because they don't recognize abnormal behavior when they see it. Other zoos have gotten sidetracked by bad ideas about animal welfare. One of the most common is the back-to-nature approach, where the goal is to make the enclosures as close to the animal's natural habitat as possible. That sounds logical until you stop to think that nature in a zoo is nothing like nature in the real world. Real nature means predators or prey, disease, hunger, and danger. Zoo nature doesn't have any of those things except disease, and a sick zoo animal gets immediate treatment from a veterinarian. The result is that some zoos have spent a lot of money building fancy enclosures that appear natural to people, but are just as boring and painful for the animals as a barren concrete cage. I remember one tiger exhibit that looked really pretty with lots of rocks molded from concrete. There was absolutely nothing for the tiger to do. The enclosure was visually stimulating for people, but it was a barren environment for the tiger. Prey species animals in zoos and fear. I'm going to start by talking about prey species animals and predator animals separately, because different animals have different weightings for the blue ribbon emotions, and the main difference is between predators and prey species animals. For prey animals, the most important emotion system zookeepers need to think about is usually going to be fear. For predator animals, the most important system is likely to be seeking. Overall, I've observed that the herbivores such as deer, Nyala antelopes, Cape buffalo, and other hoofed stock adapt much better to life inside a zoo than the large predators do. These species spend huge amounts of time in the wild eating grass and other forage, and it's easy to provide lots of forage at a zoo, which goes a long way towards satisfying their seeking system. All prey species animals are high fear. So with prey animals, your first job is to make sure you do not create an enclosure that continuously activates the fear system in the brain. I've found that many zookeepers don't realize that the physical environment is just as important to fear as it is to seeking. Zookeepers make the same mistake chicken farmers make. They assume that as long as there aren't any predators around, prey animals feel safe. But that's not the case. A hen needs a secluded place to lay her eggs regardless of whether she's ever seen a fox. In zoos, many small prey species animals need objects they can hide underneath. It's not enough to have a secluded corner they can retreat to or a barrier they can go behind. These animals have evolved to hide from aerial predators, and the only way to hide from an aerial predator is to get underneath a solid object. Primates have the opposite need. They feel exposed and scared if they don't have high places to sleep at night. In the jungle, a tree is a safer place to sleep than the ground, and many primates are hardwired to seek safety in treetops. To understand what an animal needs to feel safe, its behavior must be observed in the wild. Where does it sleep? Where does it go when it is threatened by a predator? What are the features of places an animal chooses? To keep the fear system from being chronically activated, these features have to be built into the enclosure. Old thing in a new place. It's not easy for normal human beings to understand animal fear, especially the fear felt by prey species animals in zoos. A couple of months after Animals in Translation came out, I got a call from a zoo. They were having a horrible time getting their antelopes shifted from the barn where they slept at night to the exhibit area each morning. To get to the exhibit, the antelopes had to walk through a fenced-in alley, and on some days, not every day, just some days, the antelopes were balking. They would not walk through that alley. Something was scaring them. The reason the zoo called me was that they'd read Animals in Translation, and they'd done everything the book said to do, but their animals were still going crazy. They couldn't figure it out. So I went to the zoo and talked to the keepers. They said they thought the problem had to be something to do with novelty, but there wasn't anything new in the alley, and they couldn't see anything different about the days the antelopes walked calmly through the alley versus the days they balked. They'd been over it and over it. Everything in the alley had always been in the alley and was still in the alley on the balky days. I went in and took a look. The keepers were right. There wasn't anything new inside the alleyway. The problem turned out to be that there was something old in a new position. The alley was enclosed by a chain-link fence with an electric box mounted on it that was supposed to have a warning sign attached to its side. However, the employees didn't have the screws to put it up, So they just leaned the sign up against the fence down below the box. The sign wasn't very stable propped up like that, and on some days it got knocked over. That was the problem. The front of the sign was black and white, and the back of the sign was bright yellow. When the sign tipped over, the yellow back was showing. Yellow really attracts an animal's attention. That's because the only animals that have full color vision are primates and birds. All the rest have dichromatic vision, which means that they see two main colors, bluish-purple and yellowish-green, and they don't see red. Anything yellow in the environment will pop. They'll notice it right away. Every time the sign got knocked over, the yellow back was visible on the ground, and the antelopes reacted. The fact that the sign was out of place was probably even scarier. Most days, the sign was in its proper spot, leaning up against the fence. That's where the antelopes expected it to be. Then, all of a sudden, it would be lying on the ground, and it would be yellow, too. That's a big change for an antelope. The reason the humans didn't pick up on it was that, to humans, a sign is a sign. It's so hard for normal people to think like animals. A good analogy would be if you started to walk into your living room and you saw that the sofa had been turned upside down and spray-painted a different color. That would definitely scare you. Within a species, different individuals have different hyper-specific fears, too. Most fears are learned, so different zoo animals with different histories can acquire different fears over the years. Those fears are going to be hyper-specific because they are stored in the animal's memory as pictures or sounds. Usually, the animal is afraid of something neutral that it was looking at or hearing when the scary event occurred, which makes it even harder for the human keepers to analyze. I saw a case of an elephant who feared the sound of diesel engines because he had been shoved around by a big tractor. Car engines didn't bother him. Fortunately, in that case, the keepers knew what the problem was and knew to keep diesel-powered equipment away from him. The only way to deal with hyper-specific fears is to figure out what exactly is scaring the animal through close observation. Once you identify the frightening person or thing, you have two choices. Try to habituate the animal to the object or remove it from the animal's environment. If the object is something easy to eliminate, then eliminate it. But if it's a common object, like a white shirt, habituation is recommended because we can't rid the world of white shirts. Getting an animal over its fears is easier in the less flighty species. Training animals to cooperate with veterinary procedures. Another thing captive prey species animals need is trained staff to habituate them to veterinary procedures and other necessary forms of handling. All captive animals need this, but prey species animals absolutely must have keepers who know how to habituate and train high-fear animals. The idea that you can train high-fear flight animals to cooperate with veterinary procedures was new when I first started working on it. About 10 years ago, the nutritionist for the Denver Zoo, Nancy Erlbeck, wanted to do a study to determine how much vitamin E the zoo's 4 Nialas had in their blood as part of a larger study of their nutritional health. Nialas are a small South African antelope. The trouble was that stress suppresses vitamin E levels, so if you stress the animal, it's impossible to get an accurate reading. Nancy called me and asked, "How do we get a no-stress blood sample out of an antelope?" I told her there's only one way. You have to train the animal to voluntarily cooperate during the blood test. There's no other way to do it. People thought that was crazy. Nialas are super shy, and people who knew what they were like were saying, "No, no, no, there's no way to train these animals Because they'll go berserk and kill themselves while you're trying to manipulate their behavior. Oh, yes, there is. I worked with some great students, and we trained those animals to stand still calmly while a lab technician drew blood. The secret to working with a high-fear prey animal like a Nyala antelope is to start with a very long habituation phase. Before I could even think about training the Nyalas to go inside a wood box and hold still for a blood test, we had to spend 10 days just getting them used to the sound of the wood door sliding up and down. The first day we could move the door only 1 inch, because if we'd moved it any more, that animal would have gone splat on the wall. That's what people were worried about, that we'd startle the animal and it would kill itself in its panic. The other danger we had to worry about was the fact that hyper-flighty animals can form fear memories so strong that they never get over them. If we had let them panic just once at the start, that could have made it impossible to train them. We quickly discovered that the key to successful habituation of a high-fear prey animal is to never push the animal past the orienting stage. Orienting is what animals or people do when they hear a new sound or see something strange. They stop what they're doing and look toward the new thing. During the orienting stage, a high-fear animal makes a split-second decision. Do I panic and run, or do I keep looking? The choice is either to seek or to allow fear or rage to take over.
This ends Disc 9.